Julia Anna Nini is the co-founder and director of People for People, a youth-led social enterprise on a mission for digital equity. She's also a strategy and insights specialist with a personal goal to change the statistics around the lack of diversity in the information and communications technology sector. In this episode, she tells us about her experience working with industry leaders around the world, the realities of the digital divide, and why it was important for her to come home and help create change for her people. Whakarongo mai. Kia ora, I'm Kiane. Nuku is a movement. We're empowering Indigenous wahine to be agents of change, cultivating opportunities to shape the world we want. Through this series, we're meeting 100 kick-ass Indigenous wahine doing things differently. They show us how the world can be shaped by our unique Indigenous voice. It's all about who we are and not who we've been told to be. Nuku, mahine, mohine, kiahine. Kia ora and welcome to another episode of Nuku. Today we have in the Nuku Whare Julia Anna Nini. Kia ora.
Tala for lava. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for being here. It's really awesome to not only get to have this kōrero with you today, but for me to learn a whole lot because I feel like I'm going to learn a lot out of this conversation.
No pressure.
Just in this, having a look at what it is that you do, what you've done, what you're hoping to achieve, I'm like, yep, I really should be listening to this myself.
I hope it makes sense because it still doesn't make sense to me.
Can you tell me a little bit about who you are and where you're from?
Yeah, not a small question at all to start with, but yes. I am Julia Arnott Nini. I am Samoan, Chinese and British. So my dad, Fiafia Nini, is from the villages of Tula'ele and Lalomanu in Apia, Samoa. My mum is from Lincolnshire in England.
Wow.
Yeah, she was born on the Royal British Air Force in Cranwell. And her parents met during the war, actually. My grandma was serving in the Land Army and my grandfather in the Royal Air Force at the time.
Have you been back to both of those parts of your heritage?
Yeah, well, I didn't quite make it to Lincolnshire, but I have went, I purposely went and worked over in London. So I've got a British passport through mum, which was really amazing. I was like full on, I'm going to be out, mum, I'm gone, like deuces, 10 years, here I go. Within 3 months, I couldn't handle it. Like, I could not handle how grey, how cold, how like, it's like, oh, wow, I really forgot, like, how Samoan I am and my body needs sun. Mm-hmm. So I did spend a time with my career over in England, which was really enlightening. It brought a lot of insights to me. And then we went to Samoa the last time. I think I was, like, 13, I think. It was quite a long time ago. Haven't been back for a while, but that's on the books, hopefully, in the upcoming few years.
So I take it then born and raised in New Zealand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, born and raised in New Zealand. I was born in Tauranga, but grew up predominantly in Grey Lynn before it was gentrified and bougie, back when it was the hood with my mum. We lived right next door to Grey Lynn Park on 43 Elgin Street, and it was a beautiful childhood. It was a really interesting, very interesting childhood during that time, but no, I really enjoyed Grey Lynn.
Tell me a little bit about that time, because you used the word interesting, and we talk about a lot of us who especially live in Auckland know the history of Grey Lynn, know the history of the Grey Lynn Ponsonby area, its Pacific roots, before those areas were so gentrified that you probably find it extremely difficult to find a Pacific Island person there at the moment.
Yeah.
But tell me a little bit about that time. What was that community like for you?
Yeah, well, so it's interesting for multiple reasons. One is that my mum is about 5'4", blonde hair, blue-eyed, beautiful British woman, and she has a daughter who outgrew her very quickly and has brown eyes, brown hair, and people often asked if I was adopted. Wow. So we lived a very interesting life together, but what she did with me, I guess you could say, is she introduced me to a range of different schools. So I went to Marist Herne Bay to begin with in the local area, which I really loved, and it was predominantly Māori and Pacific. And then at a certain point around year three, year four, she actually shifted me to Remuera Primary on the other side of Auckland where we went to school because my dad was in zone at the time. And the students of Remuera Primary would not come to our house for my birthday parties, for our after school like hangouts because their parents considered it to be too edgy, is probably the nicest way to put it. So it was a really interesting period growing up, and what I knew to be, I guess you could say it was quite scary at the time. My mum used to run out at nights trying to scare off people from like trying to steal her car and trying to like break in around the area. But I loved it because I lived right next door to the park. And I used to meet up with all of the local school kids. We used to go like hunting in the bushes for absolutely nothing other than our imagination. But in the evenings and in the weekends, it did become quite a, yeah, I guess it just had an underbelly to it, which you probably wouldn't have realized as a child, just until the evenings when my mum thought she was like one of the Power Rangers and going to go out and save the world. Like literally, there was one time where she honestly like left the house with a tennis racket and like chased somebody up the street because they were trying to like touch her car and she freaked out.
Boss mama.
Yeah, hardcore boss mama. So yeah, it was fun. It was fun for different reasons, a lot of resilience building. And yeah, I find it quite uncomfortable going back into the area now, like extremely uncomfortable actually. And one of the ironic things is that all of these like Remuera primary girls that couldn't come to my house for after school, guess where they're all living now?
Funny that.
Funny that. So funny that.
Did you have siblings? Or do you have siblings?
I have a half-sister through my dad, but we didn't grow up with each other. So it's just been me and my mum my whole life, basically.
Wow. So when you were younger, what did you envision for your life? What did you think you were going to go and do and be and see?
So we had he wasn't a neighbour, but there was a man that had the biggest house on our street on Elgin Street. And he had this big grand house, this big villa, and it was like two-storey with this huge outdoor property. And I asked him what he did one day, like little old Julia, and he said he was a neurosurgeon.
Oh.
So I just went, I'm going to be a neurosurgeon. I'm going to be a neurosurgeon because this man has the biggest house on the street and that's what I want to give my mum, so that's what I'm going to go do. I didn't make it past year 11 science, so that was that dream crushed real quick. But for the longest time, I thought I was going to be a neurosurgeon. I was going to be in brains and in medicine. And that was my only connection point, was that's what wealthy people have and that's how they've gotten there. So I'll go and try and do that and give that to my mum.
So what was your first job?
It was actually as a ball kid.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. So it was in the ASB in Heineken Oven. I used to go be one of those little kids running around chasing balls. We got paid $10 a day.
Oh,
yeah.
I was thinking the follow-on from the $10 was going to be $10 a ball, but okay,
no,
$10 a day.
$10 a day, $1 an hour. If you worked it started at 9 o'clock, and if you worked past 6 o'clock, you got Subway, and then you went...
Wow.
Yeah, Subway, everyone. Not even a foot long as well. I just want to call that out, like 6 inch.
A 6 inch.
That's all you got. And then you went on to the evening shift. And that was my first proper like pay job. And it was very exciting. At the end of the week, you sometimes got $100, which was amazing. And that was my first job.
How did you spend your money?
I don't even remember. I honestly don't even remember how I spent it. But I do know that I was one of like the most awkward children ever walking on to the tennis court. Like I used to hop heel to toe and look like I was bobbing. Yeah. Like I couldn't walk straight. I was just really excited to be there. So I'd just be like jumping up and down as I'm walking onto the court in front of everyone. And when my mum and my dad came to watch, they were like, oh my gosh, that's our child. Like that is our, like can she not just walk normally like everybody else? Yeah, so that was fun times, real fun times.
Yeah. Well, hey, you stood out from the crowd.
Always have to.
Just, you know.
Even if I'm not trying.
Nothing bad about that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I'm going to talk a little bit about what you do now.
Yeah.
But in between that first job, wait, did you ever get hit in the face with a ball?
No, but people did faint.
Why? Oh, because it's so hot.
Because it's so hot and we're like on $1 an hour. Can't afford water. No, that's a joke. But like, yeah, we'll just have to stand in the heat all day.
Yeah. By the way, for those who are listening, if it was a slightly noisy beforehand and now it's not, it's because we're recording in the back of the hair salon and that was a hairdryer. Yeah. And I just noticed the difference in sound.
Oh.
Just then.
Oh, wow.
As we were talking. Wow. So just putting that out there. Tell me a little bit about that in-between time. So from the time you were on the court.
Yeah.
To the amazingness that you're doing now, which we'll get to, what did that look like? And how much of that was self-driven?
I was always driven by fear. Mm-hmm. I was always driven by fear of my mother and wanting to prove to her that all of her sacrifices were worth it. That was my biggest driver and probably still is a lingering driver for me now. But basically, because I saw how much she struggled. So our British family weren't too pleased that they had a brown granddaughter. Mm-hmm. And weren't really present for my mum and supporting her as she was bringing me up. And then my dad wasn't overly present either. So my mum went through a lot of pain and a lot of hardship to bring me up and to try and give me the best possible life that she could. She went back to work when I was, I think, like 6 weeks old, something like that. Ridiculously young, she started to go back to work because it was either that or nothing. Mm. So from the ages of 13 to now being 28, I didn't really realize how much sacrifice was being had until obviously in my later sort of teens. But I always used to, my whole thing was, I suppose, being in between of a sporting kid, like being into sports, being a little bit above average, but then also my constant school reports were like, she cannot manage her impulsivity. And she's not realizing her full potential. So I was never like a straight A student. I was always just sort of trying to sort of have a good time, but while also having some level of getting things, but never was absolute. I was never an A+ student. I was never going hard. I was kind of just getting told off for talking all the time, or talking back, or cracking the jokes, or like being the clown of the class. That's definitely the
standing out.
Yeah, exactly. Definitely the persona that I was fitting into ever since, and then trying to take on all the boys and all the sports and like, naturally just beat them because
you could.
Yeah, exactly. Something like that.
Why wouldn't you?
Yeah, exactly. But I went to school in Auckland. So I went to Ponsonby Intermediate for a while. My mum then shifted us all down to Christchurch, which was incredibly white. And if I didn't want to stand out anymore, I had no choice. I was one of three brown people at my whole high school. I often experienced like reverse racism in the sense, well, not really reverse racism, but racism in the sense that like I got blamed for stealing people's lunches. I got blamed for pushing people around in school. And I definitely went through a phase there in high school as part of like adapting to survive that I just whitened myself. Mm. So I removed my Samoan last name off my name because it got so tiring having students and teachers bully me so much for it and they mispronounced it. It's like N-E-E-N-E-E. I don't know how many different ways you can pronounce it, but people got very creative. So I ended up just trying to ask for that to be taken off the school roll. And I did everything I could to just blend in. I think, as a lot of people do when they're not strong in their identity, in order to survive and to reduce the amount of pain that you experience through high school. So I think there was like a combination of things happening during that time where it was like wanting to prove to my mum that all of her sacrifice was worth it, wanting to blend into this sort of majority group that I'd been put into, and then trying to make sense of, well, how do I, in this majority, as a minority and marginalized individual, find a way to succeed in all of this? Because I wasn't the straight A student, because I wasn't leading the pack in the conventional ways that were around me. And like, in my high school, it was like excellence or nothing. And that was the kind of pressure that was constantly on. And I had no choice other than to think of university as the next step. And I literally just asked one of the girls that I went to school with, I was like, oh, what did you put down as your subjects to study? She's like, law, political science and psychology. And I was like, oh yeah, sweet, same. And just copied her, just literally straight up copied her and was like, oh, you're real smart, I should do what you're doing. And that's how my university year started. Was just like copying her name is Jenny Patton, copying what Jenny Patton wrote down for her school subjects, and then realizing that was the easiest way to have a conversation with adults. Because adults always ask you, what are you going to do after high school? What are you going to do after high school? And it can be deeply, deeply exposing and make you feel incredibly insecure if you don't have an answer. But when I said I was going to go do law, everyone would just leave me alone. So I was like, perfect. That's another way to like reduce the amount of like negativity that's projected onto me because of who I am and what I look like and how I am, if I give you this answer that makes sense to you. So that was how I started off in my early 20s. And I did unpack and self-actualize afterwards, but it took me a while. It took me a while to get there. It took me a while to recognize and realize my Indigenous side and to actually start to feel incredibly lost and empty as well. because that was what really acted as my catalyst to go yearning and go searching for who I am as a Pacific woman.
What took you to London?
So I was working...
Because when we're talking about kind of searching for who you are as a Pacific woman, and then you end up in London, it's not, probably not the place where you would find out that information.
Yeah, I got really depressed, because that was not a good move. But it was an important move to find that level of existential crisis that I quickly encountered. But basically I was working at a healthcare advertising agency kind of in this biotech space. And unfortunately, I experienced a Me Too moment, I suppose. I was a young strategic planner, and there was a strategy director who just took advantage of my kindness and interest and just my warm personality and decided that was for him to, I guess, think he has access and entitlement to. And after experiencing that moment, and I tried to share it to the CEO and the head of strategy, and they just were like, oh, well, we'll just put you in separate rooms and you won't work together.
You know, that's not how those things are meant to be dealt with.
Yeah. I soon realised that I've always wanted to go overseas because I thought that was a great way for me to stretch and just to see what I was capable of. And at the time, I was not pursuing that because I was scared. And then being in Sydney, being at this agency, my dad lives in Sydney, so I thought I was relatively safe. And experiencing that level of harm at a healthcare company, which also was quite ironic, I decided all of a sudden that actually, like, what do I have to lose? Like, what do I have to be afraid of? Bad things can happen to you anywhere. And I used that as a catalyst to start to think about, okay, well, what industries are moving forward? What industries are growth industries? How can I future-proof myself? How can I ensure that, like, I can move ahead? Given I didn't do all of, like, the strict subjects, I left law very quickly. And I saw technology as a way to, I guess, mobilize myself and from a point of view of social mobility, move up from where I came from, and I just went after it. So I applied for jobs like all over the world in like Singapore, Shanghai, London, New York, all sorts of different, San Francisco, all sorts of different cities. And I applied for like over 100 jobs and just looked at for strategy, technology, and just went on LinkedIn and went ham. And like Quick Apply was my best friend. So whenever you didn't have to write a cover letter, I was like, easy, I'm just going to apply. I didn't always read the actual job description. And then I got a call back from Romania and I was like, oh, shit, what have I done? And I was like, what the f***, Julia? So I answered the phone call and they're like, hi, this is so-and-so from HP. This is for the role, we're looking for Julia Arnott-Nini. This is the role for strategic planner of United Kingdom and Ireland. Oh, yeah. Oh, we just want to know, so why did you apply for this role? Well, it didn't say I couldn't. And that was like legit how I got to London. So I had that first conversation, had 5 interviews, got the job, left 2 weeks later and just gapped it to London. And it was partially because of fear and like because of the pain I was experiencing in Sydney from what I'd just been through. And the other part of it was ultimately my mum's definition of success for me was to get to London. So I knew that the sooner I got there, the sooner I'd be free. And that's just brutal honesty. And she was the one that was most important to me to make proud before I started thinking about anything else. So that was why London was so important to me and was on a pedestal and why I did still chase it, even though I was having these like insights around culture and identity. And it was honestly, there was a moment where I was walking the streets of London and I just was like, I had this panic attack, quite literally, and this vision of just begging mum to be like, can I please leave now? Like, I've done it. Can I go now? And so, yeah, that's kind of how I ended up in London at HP.
You know, we think about the expectations of our parents and the way we live and shape our lives to fulfill someone else's dream and to fulfill what they think is the right thing, but also because we want to be good children, because we love our parents and we want to make them proud and happy and all of these other things, often to the detriment of ourselves.
Oh yeah.
And when I listen to you speak and I listen to you talk about, you know, the sooner I got to London, the sooner I'd be free, is something that so many people feel.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that your mother's not a good mother. And it's not to say that she intentionally wanted you to not feel free, but that we so often in society today are so connected to these dreams, these aspirations, and these outcomes that our parents have for us that we don't pursue what we want to do. And finding that balance is difficult. And I guess my question is, you didn't find that balance then, and you still weren't quite free because you still went back to mum to say, can I come home?
And she said no. She even said no. She's like, no, you're going to stay there, and you should be there for at least a year.
Well, I guess the question or the coming around of that is, do you feel free now?
Yeah, I do.
And what got you to this point?
Yeah, that's it was really interesting. So I was 24 at the time, and I'd superseded her expectations. Like, she never thought I would do that fast, and no one did. Honestly, the amount of people that were like judging me hardcore when I told them I made it to the second interview of HP, and they'd be like, are you sure they know your background?
Do they know where you grew up?
Exactly. Do they know what colour your skin is? So I superseded her and a lot of people around me's expectations, even my own. Like, my imposter syndrome was so high for the first 6 months because it was also a six-month trial period, which is a long-ass period to be, like, walking on eggshells.
Yeah.
I had a sign every morning that was, like, you are meant to be here. Also, because I only got like one A plus in my whole life, I was like, they're going to find out. Straight up, they're going to find out. And then they're going to be like, we made a mistake. So I went through this journey of, I guess, I was there. I thought I was loving it. I thought I was going to love it. I didn't love it. I was unpacking and doing all of that self-work to realize, how did I even get here in the first place? Like, why did I hold this place up on such a high pedestal? Realized it was to make my mum proud, then realized I'd done that. But I was empty. I was broken. I was just almost, it was like dying while living in the sense of, you just feel incredibly purposeless. And through staying, and I will give my mum kudos for this, through staying in the tech industry, what I began to identify was the digital divide and the tech gap. And that's when I realized, holy heck, this is actually the thing. This is the thing. So I started exploring it from a lot of the conversation, we get a lot of trends reports talking about what the impact of technology is having on society and on the world as a whole. And I started to realize that, like, only 50% of the world has access to Wi-Fi. Those that actually gain the benefits of technology are those with the ones with the largest wallets. And I started to get more and more fearful around, like, the fourth industrial revolution, and now we're in the fifth. But what does that mean in terms of job displacement and relevancy of people in the workforce today? And then I took that another step further, and I thought, well, hold on a minute. If I think about Aotearoa and back home, who is most likely to be left behind? Well, that's my community. That's Māori and Pacific. And I started to search and search and search, and this yearning and this idea of, like, wow, maybe this is actually the crossover that I needed to find, and actually gave me that answer and that thing that I could hang my hat on and act in service of. So I did a real normal thing, and I emailed old mate Cindy on LinkedIn, and I was like, it was so formal. I was like, dear Prime Minister, blah, 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 blah. Like, I don't even know who I thought I was.
Yo, Cindy.
Yeah, exactly, but not, like, so formal. And I said, like, what are you doing to future-proof those most at risk of being left behind as technology advances sizably and faster and faster year on year? I didn't get a reply. That was cool. But it was in that moment that I realized this is the thing that I want to do something about. So I resigned from HP, and the actual global CMO said no, which was quite funny. I clearly had made enough of an impact. They offered me a role in San Diego in California. And that was when I started to feel like, okay, this, the ball's in my court now. Like, mum's looked after. She's got what she got she did a great job as a mum. And I can make moves now that give me a sense of, okay, well, although this is not one step closer to the tech gap and the digital divide, what it is it's building on my story as a young Pacific female that has successfully succeeded in the tech industry and can tell that story as I make my way back home. And it was honestly like a journey of navigation to follow that calling home. It wasn't straight, it wasn't linear, but I felt it every step that I was taking. I now knew that this was a building block to the thing that I wanted to get to. So I went over to the US, spent time in California. It was never a move that I knew was going to make my heart get bigger, but what I was going to do was just gain perspectives, build my tools for my kite, like actually compound what I knew and understood of the space so that I could bring it home as I journeyed my way back home. And at the end of 2019, I resigned, or tried to resign, successfully resigned again. And
just let me go.
Yeah, exactly. Like, please, my heart's not here anyway. And went to Ghana, spent 2 weeks in Ghana working at an entrepreneurs and training school, and then made it back home in February 2020. So from that point, I guess you could say I felt free in my mind, but on that landing, on the ground where I'm not attached to a company, I'm not attached to someone else's definition of success. I've, you know, battled those conversations and people think you're crazy for leaving what they think is a success. Mm. That was the moment that I felt free.
What I love about your journey and what I love about this part of your story is you seeing the value in the journey. Mm. You seeing the value in those steps that you're taking. A lot of people look at the end point and they go, that's what I want to be. And then they just focus on that.
Mm.
But they don't think about all of the tools that they're going to put into their kite along the way and all of the experience that they're going to gain and all the people that they're going to meet and the networks that they're going to get. Mm. And so often, especially young people, and when I talk about young people, I talk about our next generation and even those that are young. I mean, I'm a little bit older than you. but those that are younger than us who, because we're in such a digital world, they see the success.
Mm.
They don't see the journey that got that person to that point.
Yeah.
And so they only look for that end point. Yeah. They don't think or look at all of the path along the way. That's actually the juice. That's actually the bit. That's the bit that gets you there, that opens the doors, that gives you the experience to get you to the end point.
Yeah, like I cannot reinforce how much, like, having this title of, like, Global Social Strategy Lead at HP, having these experiences of London and California has meant that I now have like somewhere to stand on as I came home.
Mm.
People wouldn't have listened to me in the same way that they had when I made that shift home, had I not have had those, and I'm not super stoked about that this is reality, but it is reality, those labels and those points of reference that make them go, okay, I'll listen now.
Mm.
And that's not how it necessarily should be. It is how it is though. And I can't deny how staying at HP, and even though I was moving through those really tough times in myself of just feeling like I was just like all of the intergenerational sacrifice and trauma, I was just helping a CEO make more and more millions, and board make more and more millions, you know, shareholders make more and more millions on their returns on investment. All of that absolutely crushed me and killed me. However, it made it so much sweeter when I landed on that ground and I went, okay, now's the time. And I had no regrets around, I wanted to go back. I was questioning, did I still want to be overseas? I knew the pain and the depths of that pain of where I was, and it made it so much easier to come into this guns blaring, full energy. But I was fighting the whole time to, like, leave early and just race to the destination. Like, it's in my also personality type to, like, want to go somewhere fast.
I just want to be there.
Yeah, exactly.
Now,
exactly.
Yesterday.
Exactly.
Tell me about Te Kanao Te Roa, because you had sent some stats through that I feel like I knew that they were this low, but I didn't really realise that they were this low.
Mm.
So you want to change statistics, obviously, of what's happening here in Aotearoa, but the lack of diversity that exists in ICT or in the ICT sector. So there's less than 2.8% Pacific, 4.6% Māori, and 27% female representation in this space.
And that's decreasing year on year. So we're currently shit at diversity and we're getting more shit.
Is this because, like, why?
Yeah.
Why? Because we know that tech is a male-dominated industry. We know all of these things, but we don't necessarily know why.
Mm.
And why is it so hard for young Pacifica Māori women, or not even young, for Pacifica Māori women to get into this space?
So I like to think of this as a spectrum. So, like, You've got one end of the spectrum which sits at like the accessibility issue, or the issue that one end of the spectrum that sits at the accessibility, and the other that sits at, for example, like opportunities, pathways, and shifting into a creative mindset. Mm. So on one end of the spectrum, we've got the lack of access to hardware and Wi-Fi, for example, is part of a barrier to entry. Another barrier to entry is actually like subjects that are offered by high schools and the number of Māori and Pacific that are taking those subjects in high school. So for example, from the same report, there was only 9% of the entirety of Pacific students in high school that were actually studying digital technologies. If you think about that from a waterfall, you've got a very small pool at the top and it's going to get even smaller as it goes down. And so that's one of the things that I think also speaks to like what is happening in within our education system as a whole that's already impacting technology as an option and as a pathway. Another thing to think about is confidence and trust in the industry overall. And who are the key decision makers around that child, for example, that are influencing where that child then goes? So we know that medicine is a safe industry. We know that business is a safe industry because it's something to do with finance and money. You start to talk about technology as a pathway to send your young person, your child, your precious, precious gem of a human being. And that's like, I don't know what that is. I don't know what it is. I don't trust what it is. Is it safe? Where are they going? Like, who is going to be there? A lot of questions and sort of there's a big education gap around what does digital tech even look like? Mm. Like, we just recently did a white paper where for some of our respondents, you know, the digital world is Facebook. Like, that's it. And that's some of the myth-busting and education work to be done around what are the opportunities in this space. One of the other really interesting insights that I found most recently is that the concept of technology in terms of how is it actually serving my community? So an important pillar of our communities is that service is really important, service to the village, service to the wider community, and that you play a role in how us as a whole moves up in society or thrives or fulfills themselves. And what does tech do for that?
Mm.
Like as a nurse, it's very literal. It's a very literal example of service. Law is a very literal example of service. Technology is quite intangible. It's like, I don't really understand how that's helping the world to be a better place. How is that helping my village? And that's one of the other sort of, I think, interesting education points and sort of discussions to be had is around how can we see technology more as a tool than, again, as a destination. The next piece is actually just is confronting the industry as a whole. The industry, the tech industry, or like many industries, it's questionable how culturally safe any of those companies really are. It's questionable how substantive and genuine technology companies really are in diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Mm.
Because it is quite obvious from a macro scale that the tech industry overall is incredibly male-dominated, incredibly white male-dominated, with white cis male-dominated. And that has a flow-on effect around who is allowed in, who is prioritized, who is seen to be smart enough, clever enough, and obviously, like, representation matters. And so the lack of role models also has a flow-on effect around our likelihood to actually put ourselves into an industry that otherwise doesn't look like us, isn't trying to necessarily look like us, or is doing it in a very performative and tokenistic manner, like having mascots at the intern level, but not actually at the senior exec leadership level or board level.
And it has a huge impact on what is made in terms of, you know, when you're talking about service and when you're talking about how you serve the community and how, you know, what that looks like, when you only have cis white males, they don't know how to serve a Pacific community. So what they're going to create is never going to serve our community. And what they, you know, what they invest in, what kind of software, what, how they run the algorithm, you know, all of that kind of stuff will never service our communities because they are not within these communities.
Well, we're going to experience another almost, and I'm not sure if this is the right term, but like to another extent of like colonization all over again, but through technology. And there was a Māori academic who recently came out talking about the concerns of AI bias towards Māori and Pacific being more likely to be arrested.
Wow.
Because we need more of that.
Mm.
Not like Judith Collins has ever seen systemic racism in the police force, though, right?
No, because she's a coloured woman. Don't forget.
Exactly.
Don't anyone ever forget that her husband is Samoan talofa.
But this is what we're going to experience, and we are experiencing. We've seen it over in America where there's racist hand soap dispensers. So a hand soap dispenser does not pick up a black hand.
Wow.
But that's not far away. That's now. That's literally now. And like, that is why diversity matters. But it's also like the extent at which, if we don't start to change reality today, our future is going to only get harder and harder and harder in ways that we're not even aware of. And I talked to like a bunch of my friends who work in Silicon Valley, and they describe people that live outside of Silicon Valley as normies.
Wow.
So we're just the normies.
And when you talk about decolonization, you think about how difficult it is right now to decolonize our world. There is no way in hell that we would even scratch the surface of decolonizing a digital space. The big beast that it is.
Mm-hmm.
But hey, we're just normies.
We're just normies out here. We're just normies out here.
You are the founder, or the co-founder, and the director of People for People.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a bit about this organisation, this social enterprise, and where you're hoping to take it?
Yeah, so whilst I was on that journey of coming home, I ended up connecting with Saya Mataele, a wonderful Tongan man who had hosted a Pacific panel in Wellington about Pacific people in tech. And I was in California, like, lonely as hell, and being like, oh, hey, can I be your friend? Like, can I talk to you, sort of thing? And anyway, thankfully he said yes, and I probably chewed his ear off for a whole hour. But we saw a synergy between insights into the industry, and I had a lot of passion for it, and Saya was on the ground in Aotearoa. So we started thinking about ways in which we could help to create a bridge between industry and community, a bridge between education and industry, a bridge between education and community, and start to play in the space of just the intersections.
Mm.
And so our social enterprise is focusing on digital equity and strengthening digital empowerment. Digital empowerment means maximizing human potential through the use of technology. So technology is not the answer. It's just an enabler and an expander and an amplifier of us as human beings. So we're focused on a couple of different areas, definitely up at that awareness level of getting taking young people or taking Māori and Pacific into technology industries and showing them what an office and what a day in the life looks like, exposing them to different opportunities. We recently hosted a Waka experience in music and tech, where we took a bunch of beautiful men from South Auckland who were doing some work with Rep FM into Serato and Melodics, which are both New Zealand run and New Zealand kind of born music and tech companies. Serato is obviously the DJ production software, and then Melodics is a beat making platform, so to speak, a music making platform where you can learn how to play music. So we're trying to find these different bridges and these different opportunities to help expand people's knowledge of what tech is and what opportunities exist. We're doing different careers talanoas out into the community where we can continue to build on that awareness and knowledge piece. We actually have a tech drive that refurbishes and redistributes old devices for learners within the community. We're building a platform that's looking to act as a curated and centralized space for, if you're looking to engage in the digital world, you don't really know where to go. Like, not everyone knows that Google is a place to go. Not everyone knows how to use Google. Not everyone knows of all the different types of red flags that is out on the internet as well. So we're trying to create
like those lovely emails that come to you from people who just, you know, they want your bank account number so that they can send you money.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. All of that. I'm not going to talk about that. got ripped off, bought a fake ticket once. That was not stood outside the 660 concert, and I was like, nah, no, that's fake. And I was like, oh, true, Julia, you thought you were real hot shit and stuff. It was amazing.
You're supposed to be a tech genius.
Yeah, exactly.
Spot these things from a miles away.
Yeah, and then my friend was like, I thought you bought a fake one, so I bought a real one for you. And I was like, oh, thanks. Thanks, sis. Thanks. But yeah, so we're looking at trying to tackle a lot of different areas. We're trying to develop pathways into the industry. So actually, I got a beautiful text message today from a lady in Gisborne who just told me that she got a business IT analyst job on 95K, fresh out of university. She's a mother of four that went back and to study again. And she's like, thank you so much for telling me to like aim higher, think bigger, because it actually worked out. So there's a lot of stuff that I try and do just from using my knowledge of the industry to help other people to come in from that pathways piece. And then we're hoping to do a digital storytelling series to just continue to myth bust and expose. And so that's what we're focusing on for this first year is a lot of the education and awareness and some accessibility and pathway issues and trying to be a bridge between those.
That is so cool. But that's not the only thing you do. which kind of takes me, I'm going to start rattling off some things because it's one of those like long list of things and I had to underline them so I knew which bit I was reading. And so you're the director of strategy and insights at the Spinoff and Daylight Creative, and I want to talk to you about that, but I'm just going to come down to the fact that you're on a range of boards because this is also important. So High Tech Trust, Minimal Foundation, an advisor to Chive and Ignite Aotearoa, you're a mentor with First Foundation, World Economic Forum Global Shaper, a member of Navigators of Success, on top of the social enterprise and the fact that you're working really hard to like attack, smash and blow up this lack of diversity within this industry. And then, of course, you're doing the Mana Moana program and just recently we had Carlo Mila as one of our Nuku Wahine. So we've heard all about that, but you're not even 30.
Yeah, I did a life audit recently. It was actually worse than that. This is the improved
version. Oh, this is the compressed version.
This is consolidated. This is my consolidated life. Yeah, I did a life audit recently and looked at all the things, and I was doing over. It's kind of weird because that director's job is like a full time job.
Mm, yes.
So.
Mm. I gather.
Yeah. So.
I read it as that.
Yeah. My friend was like, "Is one job just not enough for you?" And I was like, I don't really know what's happened. I just, yeah.
But you see, this is an Indigenous woman thing too. Because, you know, I've interviewed quite a lot of women now.
Mm. Yeah.
Just a few. And everyone has 100 jobs.
Yeah.
Like everyone has their full-time paid job. And then they have the 20 hats that they wear on governing boards and community groups.
Yeah.
And then they, you know, some of us are also lucky enough to... to be juggling the other hats of either wife or, or mother or, you know, these other kind of other responsibilities that we hold.
Yeah.
And then there are just our own passions that we have that we want to pursue and change. And that's another thing that often we'll do without pay.
Yeah.
And it just has become this trait of an Indigenous woman.
Yeah. I was doing something about, I think it was 17 unpaid jobs and then 3 paid. And it was something along those lines. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's probably not the one. and I actually did this audit, gave it to all my friends. I was like, don't let me, I'm going to reduce this by 30%. So, yeah, this is my updated life. I feel very lucky, honestly. Again, to go back to how sad I was having the one job at HP and just being desperate to do more and be more and live more and give more, honestly. And I came home and I hustled really, really hard because I've only been home for a year, and to be able to be given opportunities within that year and be known enough and people, I guess, trust you enough and I guess or want to tokenize you enough to... be given these opportunities, I'm so grateful for, and that is partially because of my hustle, but partially because the time's right. Like when COVID hit, and it really shone the light on the digital divide like never before. I remember first coming home before COVID, and people would almost laugh in my face when I talked to them about digital divide. They're like, "What are you talking about? That's like Africa," and I was like, "Wow. You're just in your sheltered bubble. You've never seen hardship before, have you?" But when COVID hit and it became glaringly obvious that not everyone could switch to remote first, not everyone could switch to digital learning, and not everyone had devices, you know, people outside of McDonald's and libraries have been kicked out of the premises because that's their only way to access internet. Like, it made the conversation no longer, it was a non-negotiable. Mm. It was a non-negotiable. And the timing of I guess, when I came home and how my name kind of got caught up in this whole Returning Kiwis stuff, and it was just almost like a perfect storm. And I suppose I have this, I guess, almost a young person's anxiety about, like, you have one window.
Mm.
You got one window of relevancy, and if you don't run through that as hard as you can, the next gen are on your heels, the next thing is going to come up and be the top topic. You know, it's only so long the digital divide will be the one we talk about. Like, sustainability was going on, Black Lives Matter, digital divide. Like, people just churn through these social issues, and it becomes the next back page of the newspaper instead of the front page. And so I really believe that I had to, it was my duty to do as much as I could with the opportunities that I was being given and or creating, as a way to move the dial as far as I could while the window was open. Mm. So that's where I guess some of this real normal life is coming from.
I only have one question to ask you around your actual paid job. And it's not even so much about the job, it's what you do. So when you talk about strategy and insights,
mm.
what is one of the greatest insights you have learnt from and been able to do something about over this last year?
So I've only been in the job for 3 months.
Well, then for 3 months. Over the last 3 months.
Okay.
Which by the time this comes out, you would have been in it longer.
Yeah. So my job, the spin-off has recently developed itself to become a media group, you could say. So Daylight Creative is a full-service creative studio, that's is a spin-off of the spin-off, so to speak. So my role sits across both of those businesses. One is to serve internally into the business to help set ourselves up a lot more foundationally. And then the other is to serve clients that come through Daylight Creative, where we focus on just working with purpose-driven organizations. Mm. I didn't realize how much code switching I was doing until I was like, oh, I'm part of an agency, plus I'm also in, yeah. And then I said, oh, that's why there's so much fatigue. Anyway, one of the difficult insights that I've recently come through is around child poverty. Mm. We were working with an organization that's looking to help unlock or break child poverty. And some of the insights from their research was that a lot of New Zealanders look at poverty as though it's self-inflicted. And so much of the conversation, when it even comes to child poverty, is it's the child's fault.
Mm.
And that's probably one of the most heartbreaking insights that I have encountered, in the sense of, we still look at poverty not as an systemic issue, not as an institutional structural issue, but it's the individual's fault that they are there. And through that, we were able to support this business with a strategy or with an approach to how they can speak to certain demographics and certain mindsets. But I really just said, you know, do not even bother with the non-persuadables. Do not even bother with that group that have that belief, mm-hmm. because they are not worth your energy. And ultimately, we're not ever going to convert those people. And work with the willing, work with those that have a mindset of like team of 5 million, work with those that think about the opportunities and where they were born into and how not everyone is able to access the same level of privilege as they are, and speak to the spirit and the mindset much more than speaking to a demographic in terms of age or location. Mm. And that one's still in the works, but that was one of the most, I find, painful insights are some of the most poignant and some of the most memorable, and that was a really painful insight to uncover.
What is it like to be an Indigenous woman in the world today?
You know, I was, when you asked me to come on to be part of Nuku and to kind of have a podcast, I had a moment wondering whether or not I was actually eligible enough to honour the term an Indigenous wahine. As you've heard about, I grew up with my British mother, and I'm on a journey to come closer to my Samoan side and my sense of being a Samoan woman. And having walked both worlds, or having walked predominantly my Pākehā and mainstream world, and now much more so in my Pacific community in the Pacific world, I'm finding it incredibly hard to find a space of belonging, because in one side you're too white for one world, and the other side you're too brown for it. And in this kind of, in this no man's land, in this in-between, which there will be a lot more of, individuals that fall in this space, or not even fall into it, that are born into this space of multiple worlds, third culture, third spaces. I'm looking forward to those days. But right now, I think it's just, it's incredibly hard. However, it's finally empowering. It's finally, you can walk with pride. You can walk with your head up. You can walk knowing that your ancestors are following you, and they always have been, and they're on your shoulders, and they're, and that you can speak up and not get crushed the same way you could even just 2 years ago. I guess working on behalf of a media company, it means I've got like a pretty cool crew behind me, and I'm like, yeah, don't fuck with me. But I definitely feel as though I have found my voice a lot more in last year and in this year than I ever have done before. But still, like I would say that even the Pacific community can be some of the most cruelest individuals, much more so than mainstream, much more so because it's so deeply connected to your sense of being inferior. So I'm on that journey to understand what that means for me. And obviously with that comes a sense of displacement and a sense of confusion and sort of just trying to find peace in that.
And there are many on that journey. And there are many who, with mixed heritage, question their eligibility, question their worthiness, question their enoughness. And it's something that we have discussed many times on this podcast with many women, and you're not the only one who we've asked to come onto Nuku who's then said, but I don't know if I am enough. And one of the things that I'm loving about Te Ao Māori at the moment, which is infiltrating, you know, our mana moana family, is that all you need is whakapapa, that whakapapa is enough. Because when we start breaking down the percentages, and when we start breaking down the, but this is how I was brought up, but this is how, and then we go back to actually, you know, the fact that a colonization is real, and colonization, this is still a flow and effect of that. And there is so much for us to unpack and reclaim and slowly crawl our way back into. And I love how you describe, you know, that third space, because actually the majority of our world fit into that third space. When you talk about your identity and when you talk about growing up with your mum, it actually makes a lot of sense now when I read that you were once in Irish dancing competitions.
I chose that over doing the Samoan dancing. I did.
So yes, that totally makes sense now.
Still just yearning to fit in.
When we think about our space in this world as Indigenous women, what do you think, and you sort of have already mentioned part of it as well, that we ourselves, our own people, are some of our worst critics, some of our hardest people to live with and be around, and are some of our harshest, harshest people to come up against, especially when it comes to that topic of worthiness and enoughness. But when you look at our world today, and as an Indigenous woman walking in this world, in this third world, what is one of the greatest things that you see about your heritage or your culture? And when I say you, I sort of reflect that as us here in Aotearoa and in the Pacific.
I thought of blooming, I thought of blossoming, I thought of thriving, I thought of just the bursts of creativity that are shooting through and that are bubbling up in their own little niches and their own little pockets and spaces, but at like a groundswell. And I think that's one of the most beautiful things to observe at the moment, are all of these little pockets and these safe spaces and these hubs for ideas, for people, for thoughts, for businesses, for creative outputs, whatever it is, as they are fed and are watered, that becomes the new swell of change. And it is all levels of the embracing of us. Obviously, performative and tokenistic is not my favorite whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Pretty anti that. However, all of those, like, that's a sign of that groundswell working. You know, it's a sign of us rising step by step, pocket by pocket, piece by piece. And as that ladders up, you know, that creates that tsunami effect almost. And that's what I'm loving seeing at the moment and loving hopefully being part of in my own way. And that's what I try and hold on to, is that I'm not made for everyone. And the change that I'm creating in my small little, like, pocket is part of a bigger amount of change that's happening around me. And it's with all of us does the systems change happen. It's mm-hmm. not just with one of us in one space in one way. It's all of us doing works in our different spaces. And we had Tina Nata come to Mana Moana over the weekend and talk to us about the doctrine of discovery, which was full noise.
Another one of our Nukuwahine. You can go back and listen to Tina Nata's podcast. It's pretty incredible.
Carlo even said that Tina is the most important person in Aotearoa right now. And I was like, wow, flex. but what Tina talked about was just that all of us are doing our work to decolonize, all of us in our own ways, from its conversations, from its full activism, from its in boardrooms to on the ground and grassroots. That is all important. Mm. And that is all part of the change that we want to see.
When we think about the change we want to see.
Oh my gosh.
And this is the question that you and I discussed before we even started this podcast, because you were like, I don't know if I have an answer. Mm. But everyone has an answer. And actually, even if the answer is just specifically relevant to what you're trying to achieve through the work that you're doing. But the last question that I have is, what is your hope for the future of Indigenous women?
I hope that we stay in our power, stay in our autonomy, stay in our, like, sovereignty, and we decide what thriving Indigenous women look like, that it sits within us in our own way. That's what I hope for. I hope that we either reclaim, we discover, we retain our power, retain our backbone, retain our truth, our light, and that we decide what we want to see. That's all, because that's enough. Like, then the outcomes will follow. I don't know what the outcome looks like, but I know that if every one of us is standing in our highest selves, standing in our power, that will lead to a better world.
That's awesome. Thank you. Thank you for having the kōrero with me today. Thank you for teaching me more about the tech space, because... because I don't know a lot, to be honest. But also, just thanks for sharing. Like, the kōrero that you have is so inspiring. And when you talk about, when I reflect back on your kōrero and you talk about freedom, that's powerful. Mm. You know, when we talk about what makes you feel trapped in a space and then what makes you feel free, is not always what society, it's not always how society sees you as being free. And I think that's one powerful take that I'm going to take home with me from this quarter. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
I cannot wait to see more if this is what you've done in a year at home.
Oh yeah, pray for me to hold on. Yeah.
Amen. Alright, thank you so much. Ka kite. Before you go, did you know we have a Nuku shop? We sell Nuku kākahu, clothing, whakakai, earrings, and gifts for mama, and we sometimes stock the products of our Nuku 100 wahine. You can check it out at www.nukuwoman.co.nz/hoko. 100% of all profits made in the Nuku store go directly into amplifying the voices of kick-ass Indigenous wahine. Check it out today.